Thank you, Tom. It's so nice to be here tonight, and it was nice to come in and be able to be part of the Vespers service and just be part of a Eucharist service this evening. I had Eucharist yesterday afternoon in Baltimore, Maryland, where I was learning from a Lutheran congregation there, doing work in some really economically disadvantaged parts of Baltimore, about a mile or two away from where Freddie Gray was killed. And just to see the incredible, beautiful work that they're doing there. But then, of course, I had to get up really early this morning, catch a plane. It was just nice to have Eucharist tonight. So I want to tell you a little bit about myself. I've been a pastor for 26 years. I grew up in Eastern Washington State in a town of 300 people, which means that from my perspective, even being with all y'all tonight is a cross-cultural experience, right? Because, like, they're just, you know, my hometown was pretty homogenous, right? And my family and I didn't get out very much. So what happened is I've been serving in the Episcopal Church since about 2004 in both Lutheran and Episcopal contexts. And most recently, I was director of St. Philip's in Marysville that had kind of gone through some really tough times and gotten down to about 12 to 15 people on Sunday. And so they had a lot of different challenges. But the one thing they had was really, like, open, caring hearts, right? They didn't know how to do a worship bulletin. And their website was a plea to the gods of the internet for help. But they loved people when they walked in the room. And because they did that and were willing to work, we were able to get to the point where they have about 40, 45 people on Sundays. And they just called a new rector, who I'm just very pleased about. So what happened is, when I moved to Marysville, the treasurer there took me out for chicken fried steak. Because he loved the chicken fried steak at this restaurant, which happened to be run by a Pakistani man and his wife, who are very, very lovely people. And I didn't have the chicken fried steak. I had the chicken jalfrezi, which was really, really, really good, you know, kind of a curried chicken thing. And we went there a couple times, and I got to know Shabir a little bit. And I said, "Shabir, do you know any Muslims around that I could get into some conversation with?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And so he got me connected up with a civil rights advocate for Muslims. And then at the funeral of that treasurer, which is a very sad, sad thing, I met a woman who was a Buddhist. And she got me connected up with a Buddhist. And so the Buddhist and the Muslim and I began to do some interfaith kind of conversations. And we did a number of those in Marysville. And then I was talking to some folk in Oak Harbor who said that they really wanted someone to come in and kind of, like, you know, answer some of the questions about Islam and how we could, like, be a little more open to Muslims. And so on one of the scariest days of my life, we went down to Oak Harbor to the public library and did this presentation. And I had literally four PowerPoint presentations ready, none of which were really any good at all. But somehow the Holy Spirit worked, and we had a really good event. And so we were invited to do more. And what I began to notice at these events was that every time we went to a different town, we heard the same questions, phrased almost exactly the same way, in almost the same order, with almost the same emotionality everywhere we went. Well, like, what's going on here? These are different people in different towns. Like, what's happening here? And so what happened is that I began to learn that there are some very specific reasons why we're so afraid and why we are told to be so afraid of Muslims in certain ways. And as I began to dig into that, we began to do more of these kind of events. And then finally, after the Paris attack, my friend and I, Jaffer, who lives in Linwood, we thought we better put on another event and this time bring in more speakers. And after we announced that event, then the San Bernardino attack happened, and then we began to hear about Muslim bans. And so instead of the normal, like, 80 to 75 to 100 people, we ended up with 450 people in that room. And it was a lot to deal with, and TV cameras and that kind of stuff. And so what happened the next morning is that I got phone calls and emails from Lutheran and Episcopal clergy all over Western Washington saying, would you be willing to host one of those kind of events at our place? And of course, that's one of the reasons that we're a diocese together, is that we know each other, and if we want to do an event somewhere, we call somebody up, and because we know them, we know their email address, and we have a place, right? And so we went ahead, and it was kind of a gut check, you know, do I really want to do this, right? Because I could probably pat myself on the back a little bit nice for having done that nice event, and I could go home. But I prayed about it a lot, and I decided we needed to do it. Because you could feel at that point in 2015 the steamroller going, you know, that you could feel like the hate and the scapegoating stuff kind of starting to gain momentum, and we had to do something. So we did about 10 of those events, and I about killed myself doing that in actually two other churches. And then during Holy Week on Wednesday I was kind of home trying to write some sermons and get some rest, take a little nap, take the dog for a walk, that sort of thing. And I was talking to a Muslim friend on the phone, and I said, you know, information's great, but relationship is what's going to change it. And so what we need is someone to go into to churches on Sunday mornings and other times of the week and sort of help prepare them for relationship with Muslim communities and, frankly, all kinds of faith communities. And then I heard my voice say, I think I need to do that. And that really screwed me up. So I was hoping my wife would talk sense into me, so I told her what happened that evening. And all she said to me was, well, maybe you should listen to that. For which I'm not happy with her, right? I want you to know. So I talked to Bishop Greg, I talked to the Lutheran bishop, I talked to lots of clergy colleagues and friends and family, and decided finally to resign from St. Philip's and to start something called Neighbors in Faith. And the thing about the Neighbors in Faith thing, you can see that there's it's about Muslims and Christians right now. But I sort of see this like a telescope, right? And if you start pulling the telescope out, there's all kinds of other faith communities there. It just, I sort of feel called to work on the Muslim-Christian part of it right now, right? So I just want to be clear about that. So right now we are in an incredibly changing, deeply challenging time in our larger world. I don't need to tell you. But there's three, I think, questions that I think are really plaguing us, and we almost don't know how to formulate them, and we really don't know what the responses are. The first one is, how are human beings going to understand life? How are we going to embrace it and find its meaning? When there are literally 7 billion of us, right? Like, there's a lot of people that could stand up and do a presentation about this, right? There's a lot of people. So any one of us could go away and the world would go on just fine, right? What does it mean to be one of 7 billion? How do we live together given our cultural differences? When those differences aren't just across the world, but they're right next door. They're right in our same pew. How do we deal with that? How will we live together while respecting the earth and our children? A huge issue. Because we know we cannot continue to use the resources at the rate we are and expect our kids to do okay. And one of the key things that's like driving anxiety in all of this is this number right here, this percentage, 85%. And this sort of deep anxiety, it really came out in this last election. And that's a study from Ball State University, which we all mostly didn't hear about, that said the job losses in manufacturing from 2000 to 2010, 85% of them were due to automation. 85%. Which means that by 2010, if we were still producing manufacturing things at the same efficiency rate as we were in 2000, we would have 9 million more manufacturing jobs in the country in 2010. So that means 9 million people lost their jobs. They lost their jobs, and then they saw their neighborhoods change with people overseas moving in. And then we heard our national leaders, some of whom did not tell us this number, and some of whom decided that we want to pick on two groups. We want to take all the energy that's underneath all these deep changes all these deep challenges and focus them on a couple of groups: Mexicans and Muslims. So we are in a time, and of course, let's go back and talk about those 9 million people and all the other sort of economically sort of, you know, sort of threatened folk in this country who feel like their small towns and their farming communities and their manufacturing centers, like they're just not producing the jobs they used to. And let's just think about what our culture has told them, where they find meaning. In this culture, we have told people, you have meaning to the degree that you produce stuff. That's where you have meaning. And so when folk lost jobs, they didn't just lose a job, they lost an identity. That work ethic that we talk about, in many ways, functionally is the religion of our nation. Now, you could say there's other components of that economical religion, right? But that's a big one. And so folk didn't just lose a job, they lost an identity and even the promise of one. And so when they see other groups come in, what happens? Well, you start to get tribalistic. You try to define your identity not by what you have or not by what you lost, but by who's different from you. So tribalism is the possession of a strong cultural or ethnic identity that separates people in one group from another group. And there's not a very far step from tribalism, where we're gaining our identity about who we're not, about who we're different from, to exclusionism, which is the idea that people that are not part of my group are maybe not fully human, and they do not deserve the same things I deserve. And so what I think is happening under the pressure of all of these deep changes, including the whole automation wave that is starting to hit our world, is that folk are trying to find identities by who they're not. And once you're doing that, it is very easy to do scapegoating. And scapegoating is what happens when you take an undifferentiated, sort of unknown anxiety, and you focus it on a vulnerable person or group. And so when Donald Trump comes down the escalator and he says, Mexicans are rapists and the Muslims are out to get us, right? He's engaging in scapegoating. He's not dealing with the real questions underneath the changes to our culture and to our society. He's saying if we got rid of those people, we would all be fine. And of course, the problem is that we have seen in the last year that once you start to like let loose the dogs of scapegoating, to mix metaphors, in a society, what happens is that all vulnerable groups of people start to suffer. So the GLBTQIA community begins to suffer and are experiencing tremendous fear. Not just about what legally might happen with respect to marriage, but just to their physical safety in the world. Not just to where they go to the bathroom, but whether or not they're respected. Certainly our Jewish sisters and brothers are experiencing it. And we all know our Sikh brothers and sisters are experiencing it. And our Hindu sisters and brothers, too. And it just keeps going. So what we are trying to do with Neighbors in Faith is to say that every group we work with is going to buy in on some values. That we're going to seek out neighborly relationships with people of other faith or non-faith traditions. And it's really important that we say non-faith traditions too. Like if there was a group of atheists around, let's have a conversation, right? We want to resist in ourselves and in others and in society exclusionist ideologies that help us dehumanize each other, and to work in the public arena for the human rights of all people. So we want to do that, but we have to realize that we are in a larger climate of deep anxiety, and fear can very easily become kind of its own little ecosystem and get us moving in ways that we will later regret. So the reality is, and this is just one chart out of many that I could put up here, of people in Western societies not respecting Muslims or Islam. And you can see on the bottom of the chart, the United States is kind of leading in this area. 52% of the population do not respect Islam. Okay? In a recent Chapman University study, 58%, almost 60% of Americans said that Muslims should have more intensive airport screening than anybody else, simply because they're Muslim. A Muslim gentleman I know who is a leader in his own town went through the border crossing up by Blaine, and at first they thought he was Mexican. So they started talking Spanish to him. And then the officer looked down at his ID card and his eyes got about this big around, and he almost stuttered and stammered and fell out of the room to go get his supervisor. They did some computer research on him and found out that he was a good guy, but they did have one piece of advice for him. You should change your name. He should not have the name Muhammad, apparently. Right. So there's a fear thing going on here. And of course, a lot of times we notice Muslims by the way they dress, especially the women. And so, I'm sorry, I went too far. So we got a title for this response to Muslims. It is not a perfect title, and it can be taken too far. We use the term Islamophobia to refer to an illogical, not fact-based fear of all Muslims, kind of a broad brushing of all Muslims as all being the same as our negative stereotype, okay? And of course, we see the hijab and, you know, people kind of freak out, but of course, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is never really shown anywhere without wearing a hijab. And you all know why that is? Because she's a secret Muslim. No, I'm sorry. Because people in the Middle East, they had a very different culture, right? And so and there were parts of that culture that today we would critique, right, in certain ways. But they generally saw hair as kind of like a private part. Your hair is for your family. Your hair is for your spouse. And so they wear their hijab as part of a spiritual practice. And my good friend Amanda Smith says that she wears the hijab, who is a Mormon who became a Muslim, right? She wears her hijab to claim for herself the spiritual practice that her body and her beauty are meant for her spouse and for herself and not for public consumption. So that's the way she sees it, right? And I should say that the Apostle Paul is saying that all the Christians in the room who are women who are not wearing hijabs are evil tonight, right? That's actually not what he's saying. What he's saying is Christians should fit into the clothing mores of their area if they're starting to get under pressure, right? So what we've seen in the last year is an incredible rise, not only in fear and suspicion of Muslims, but we've seen a rise in the number of hate groups. In 2015, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there were 34 hate groups in the United States. And in 2016, there are now 101. Now, that sounds bad, but it's way worse than it sounds. Because some of these groups have chapters across state lines, all the way across the country. There are whole groupings of Islamophobic hate organizations that ally with each other to produce websites and white papers and YouTube videos that basically tell everyone that Muhammad is a rapist, violent person who's a horrible, despicable person, and he founded his religion on a political ideology intent to dominate the entire world. That's what they're trying to sell. And so one of those groups came to an event that I was leading about a month and a half ago. They sent 5 people to disrupt our event, to interrupt speakers, and once the question and answer started, they did not let people answer. It's a group called Act for America. They have 300,000 people, a part of their organization, and they have 5 chapters here in Western Washington. Actually, not too far from here, just down the road in Tacoma. So we have to start asking ourselves why we are so afraid. Well, one part is the narrative that the media tells. And by this, I do not mean journalism. I just mean like the normal story that, you know, newsish programs produce. And during 2013, a group called Media Tenor looks at the way the media portrays various subjects or groups. And what they found was that during a 10-month period, CBS, NBC, and Fox News had only 5% of their coverage showing Muslims in a positive light. Only 5%. Christians did a little bit better, but, you know, not a lot better either. If you look at movies, there was 1,000 films that had Arab or Muslim and or Muslim characters from the year 1896 to 2000. Only 12 of them were positive. Only 12 of the characters were positive. 52 were neutral, and 936 were negative. So if you're a little kid from a small town, and you've never met a Muslim, what do you think? The Cato Institute, which is hardly a liberal think tank, last year got very concerned about some of the rhetoric toward Muslims and how that might impact policy. And so they did a little study. And their study showed that your chance of being murdered by a non-terrorist in the United States is 1 in 14,000 per year. Your chance of being murdered by a terrorist is 1 in 3.6 million. But if you ask most people what they're most afraid of, what captivates most of their imagination, what takes most of their emotional energy, it's probably the foreign-born terrorist. And so what we have to understand is that there has been a well-funded network we now call the Islamophobia industry that has been working since even somewhat before September 11, 2001, but right afterward they all began. And these groups are funded to the tune of between $10 and $20 million a year. It's at least 10. It's probably more. And they relate to each other. They support each other. They raise a lot of ruckus with each other. And they're out there spreading a lot of lies. And the messages that they tell at their heart is that religion is the source of violence, and especially Islam. Now, the reason I put religion instead of Islam there is that in Western society, there's a pretty strong bias against religious and religious people. You know, all religious people are just kind of nuts. They're not rational, right? So that's why I put that there. But what they're saying is that Islam is uniquely leads people to violence. And that Muslims are not American, and they want to impose Sharia law on everybody, and that Islam is a violent ideology and not a religion. That there's a secret plot to destroy the U.S., and basically every Muslim is some kind of, even subconsciously, some kind of little secret sleeper cell, you know, member, right? And that all Muslims are terrorists or terrorist wannabes. So that's the messages that they sell. And those messages that they sell are not all that different from some other messages that have been sold. And what I want to say about this, this poster, one of hundreds, if not thousands of messages during the 1930s, that it worked. Remember that it worked. Not with Germans, but with human beings. It worked with human beings. They said the Jew is the inciter of war or the prolonger of war. And of course it ends there, but it actually doesn't end there. If somebody is threatening you, if someone is a cancer, what do you do to a cancer? You cut it out. You use chemo. You want to destroy it, right? So the poster implies that violence against the group is justified because the group itself is violent. So here's some other nice little images. Convert to Christianity, you die, says radical Islam. Convert to Christianity, you die, says moderate Islam. Moderate Islam holds up the bomb. Radical Islam is lighting it off. And so I have with me a belt buckle. You guys can look at it later if you want to. It's a belt buckle from a German uniform in World War II. Anybody know what it said on the belt buckles? Gott mit uns. God with us. Right? And we trust that God is big enough to be with each of those soldiers when they put their pants on and they buckled up their belt. But we also know that that claim means something else. God is on our side, and God is against those other people. And we got some of that going on. In fact, in a 2015 poll, these are probable primary voters of both Republican and Democrat, 25.5% were in favor of bombing Agrabah. 51% were not sure if we should bomb Agrabah or not, which is a city, right? And you know what happens in a city. Think about all the things that happen in cities. And if you bomb a city, all the people that are going to be targeted. Well, this is Agrabah. Right? Right. So what I'm not saying by this is that the people that voted for this are stupid. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that they're afraid. And they've been made to feel afraid. And of course, there's some legitimacy to that fear. Right? Because we all know that that terrorism does happen. And we all know, many of us in this room lived through September 11, 2001. And we've experienced the emotions. Like, I felt like I wanted all Muslims to go away. I had twin daughters who were in second grade. I didn't want that to happen to them. I didn't want them to experience all that fear. But, you know, in our faith, we're told we got to, like, you know, process emotions and look at them through the lens of faith and kind of start to evaluate whether or not those impulses are really where we want to be. Right. So I've come a long way since there. And a lot of it is false framing. We basically said that terrorism is of primarily a religious origin. The reason that terrorism happens in the Middle East is because they're Muslim or because they're religious. What I think is a truer way to frame it is that political violence, which is the definition of terrorism, violence intended to change a political outlook or outcome, has a political source. So terrorism grows in the soil of political and economic oppression, denied human rights, and a sense that people's very future and culture is being threatened. And if you put any group of people inside that kind of context for enough time, some people are going to resort to violence. And what happens is that the soil of oppression happens, and people's future, their kids, their parents are being impacted by totally unjust situations. And some people are going to engage in political violence. And because human beings do not live by bread alone, because we like to have meaning for our actions, we want to justify our anger in what we do, then we begin to twist whatever ideology we have, whatever religion we have, to justify our actions. And what we have to understand is that in the Middle East, and in whole large swaths of this world, but very intensely in the Middle East, that Western powers, including the U.S., have been engaging in colonialism or neocolonialism. Colonialism is when you control stuff so you can grab all their resources. Neocolonialism is when you support often unjust governments so you can receive all of their natural resources. You at least have first dibs on it, right? And so what has happened is that we actually didn't care. We actually didn't care what was happening to people in those countries. So Michael Clare, a guy who wrote a book called The Resource Wars, says that the challenges of Middle Eastern conflict may be framed in the language and ritual of religion, but they will arise from hostility to the U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf area, a presence dictated for the most part by Washington's unwavering determination to control the supply of a precious resource. Jimmy Carter said, any attempt by an outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interests of the United States of America, and such an assault will be repelled by any means necessary. And we all know what that resource is, right? So what happens is that the soil of oppression takes place in these countries, has taken place, and some people have been radicalized. Now, there's also been a lot of mainstream Islamic critiques of colonialism and neocolonialism that have very harsh things to say about the U.S., whose leaders have never encouraged violence. But but have had a strong critique anyway. We don't hear about those folk too much. Right? So the radicalization happens, people do political violence, and then what happens is that the population in the U.S. begins to react. We begin to justify our actions there based on the fact that there was terrorism from there. And so then we actually become radicalized. So in a really excellent book called Friction, it talks about radicalization and political violence. They say that radicalization emerges in a relationship, in a friction of intergroup competition and conflict that heats both sides. And this relationship must be understood if radicalization is to be kept short of terrorism. Focusing on them is not enough. Focusing on us is not enough. Focusing on the dynamics of the conflict is essential. So what I want to say to you right now is that huge swaths of the American population have actually been radicalized. And certain swaths of my own soul have been radicalized. Hate crimes. According to the FBI, 51% of the religiously motivated ones were against Jews. 22% were anti-Islamic or Muslim. The previous year it was 16%. And many of you have probably heard the studies that have shown that hate crimes and hate incidents have really gone up in this last year. I am nervous to see what they're going to be. A very recent study that just came out found that 57% of Muslims have never had any kind of bullying with their kids. 14% have had it once in the last year. 20% have had it a few times in the last year. And 8% or so have it almost every day. So there is tremendous bullying taking place toward kids. And of course, if you go on the internet, you can sort of justify it pretty quickly because there's lots of websites that help you feel afraid. In fact, you can even go straight to the Quran and feel afraid. This one translation of the Quran, which is basically their Lord's Prayer, says, "The way on those whom you have bestowed your grace, not the way of those who earned your anger, such as the Jews, or those who went astray, such as the Christians." But what you find out is that the parenthetical statements there are not in Arabic at all. They've been inserted. This version of the Quran is supported by the government of Saudi Arabia. And they put it out everywhere. So this is actually much closer to what it says in the Arabic. "The path of those whom thou hast blessed, not of those who ensure wrath, nor of those who are astray." In other words, this is the "lead us not into temptation" part of their prayer. It is intended for self-critique, not for the exclusion of other people. So some basic facts. There's about 1.6 or 1.7 billion Muslims. That number goes back and forth all the time. About 2 billion Christians. 3.3 million are U.S. Muslims in this country. Our population generally assumes Muslims make up 17%. Because if they're 17%, they're super scary. If they're 1%, they're not so scary. 80,000 Muslims in Washington State. There's about 50,000 Muslim doctors in this country. 10,000 people serving in the military. 20% of Muslims in America are African American. 24% of the Muslims born outside the U.S. come from Middle Eastern and North African countries, which means that 76% come from the other 50 majority Muslim countries. Not all Muslims are Arab, right? So 47% attend religious services as compared to Christians, 45. 56% believe other religions can lead to salvation. 62% of people watch sports. 89% believe killing civilians is never justified. I'm saddened by the Christian number. And only 38% of us, roughly, at least as of a couple years ago, have ever experienced a Muslim. So what we have to understand is that genocide is a process. It starts with classifying people as different from us, symbolizing certain things about them, like the hijab, or a turban, or some kind of head thing, or a head rag, or whatever you want to call it, and dehumanization. Those people aren't like us. And so Genocide Watch calls this like the process of genocide. And it seems like we're already getting there. And so if we think back to the German era and what was happening there with the church, what we kind of realize is that the German church had two sins. One sin we're all familiar with. They did not, in enough numbers, stand up for their Jewish sisters and brothers. A lot of them did, and a lot of them died. Right? They took out like 5,000 pastors right away and practiced, you know, killing those folk first. But not enough did. But the reason not enough did is because of the previous sin, which was that they didn't know their Jewish sisters and brothers. They didn't have potlucks. They didn't sit down for coffee or for wine. They didn't get together and do things as part of communities together. And so this leads us to what we can do. What can we do now in this very anxious time where scapegoating is kind of getting ahead of us and out of control, in which the anxieties of our time are getting the best of us? So you all know that the Hebrew core of their religion, the central tenet, is love of God and love of neighbor. And hopefully, if you've been part of a Christian church, you know that the Christian core is love of God and love of neighbor. No big surprise there, right? But, as I'm sure you heard from your previous speakers, the Muslim core is, there is no God but God, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. And none of you has faith until you love for your neighbor what you love for yourself. And let's just talk about the first one for a minute. So a lot of Muslims would say that anybody who believes in God is already a Muslim, just not with a capital M. They just don't buy the second part of that first sentence. But they're already Muslim, right? So I'm sure you heard the last couple weeks from the Quran, it says, surely those who believe, those who are Jewish, the Christians and the converts, anyone who believes in God and believes in the last day, in other words, believes there's a moral universe, right? And leads a righteous life, will receive their recompense from their Lord. They will have nothing to fear, nor will they grieve. So there is, right in the heart of the Quran, an awareness of and an acceptance of other monotheistic faith traditions. And in fact, after the most intense statement about monotheism, right after it, it says there is no compulsion in religion. So even God does not use compulsion to make people believe in God. So religion, you know, is then a matter of choice. That's a beautiful statement. And so if there was, for instance, a Lions Club member who wore the little blue jacket and went around, and you guys know what Lions Club people are known for, right? Glasses, eye exams, right? If someone got one of those jackets and went around and tore people's glasses off and stomped them on the ground and said that person was representing the Lions Club, would you believe them? Of course not, because you know the Lions Club is all about helping people have vision. So what we've done is we've allowed people who are doing expressly what the Quran forbids, expressly what Muslims do not believe in doing, with being able to define their faith. And how would it feel then for us if others allowed the KKK or white nationalists to set the boundaries and the core of the Christian faith? That'd feel terrible. But that's kind of what we've been allowed to do. So what I'm suggesting is that we go back to our core as Christians. We've got to figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to respond to Muslims during this incredible time of scapegoating and fear. We need to love. We remember that we're part of a monotheistic faith, and that we're called to love our neighbor. Let's talk about monotheism just for a quick second. So you know that not too many centuries ago, really, a couple of millennia ago, most human beings were organized in little tribes. And the people in the tribe next to you, you might share some words, but you know, maybe they talk different and they dress a little differently. and they sure smelled funny, right? So they had a different God. And so when they got into conflict with each other, their gods were fighting up in the heavens while they were fighting below. And in a beautiful, you know, kind of example of inspired religious imagination, someone had an idea. Instead of there being multiple gods, there's just one. And therefore, all of us are the children of that same God, and therefore, we're at least third cousins, and therefore, when we have a problem with each other, we don't get to kill each other anymore. We've got to do the hard business of working it out. We're called to love each other. And so, what does love mean? Love means to work for the well-being of your neighbor. And well-being includes things like housing, and a job, and respect in the community, and access to health care, right? It includes those kinds of human rights. Love means you don't have to wait for a perfect neighbor to be a neighbor. Jesus was very clear. You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you. Even if the most fevered dreams of our most Islamophobic, most radicalized American citizens is true about Muslims, this is still what Jesus calls us to. Now, Christians can decide if they're up for it, but it's very clear what Jesus is talking about. You do not have to wait to be a perfect neighbor before being a neighbor. Because at some point in the process of getting to know people in other faith traditions or other cultures, we're all going to say some pretty dumb things. Right? Don't let that fear get in your way. Be open to a learning process. And know that you know, anybody who's moved here anytime recently knows American culture way better than we do, probably, and knows how to handle it when we make a mistake. Right? And so just smile and say, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. And then they'll tell you what to do and you move on. It'll be okay. We do not have to wait for the larger culture to agree who we can be neighbors with. In the Hebrew scripture, it was very clear that we're to care for the orphan, the widow, and the immigrant, the poster children for all vulnerable people in the Hebrew scripture. Just a shorthand language for that. In Exodus, it also says, do not follow a majority in wrongdoing. And then in Matthew 5, Jesus is very clear. He says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. He didn't mean people who were unknowingly Christian. He meant people who are willing to love their neighbor when it didn't seem quite easy to do so. So the idea here is to love the God beyond our idea of God. Paul Tillich's beautiful statement. So we all know what idolatry is. Idolatry is thinking that we got God figured out. So God's bigger than our notion of God. So people ask sometimes, well, is the Muslim God the same God as the Christian God? And I say something like, well, something smart alecky like, I didn't realize there was a national faith league of religions. And that there's this big competition, and this week it's Moses versus, you know, Muhammad. You know, watch on Sunday at 2 on Fox, you know, whatever, sports news, right? That is not what we're talking about. What we're saying is that there is one creator. And we may have some different theological, you know, thoughts about that God, some different understandings of the character of that God with our sisters and brothers who happen to be Muslim or Jewish or whatever. We can have those conversations. But we believe that there is one creator, whatever our understanding of that is. And then what we have to remember is that love, that our neighbor is going to be a blessing to us, which is sometimes hard for white folk to remember, especially white Northwestern folk who all have this culture, many of us have this culture of like independent, you know, we're going to take care of it all ourselves and, you know, we're the pioneers and stuff like that and we don't need anybody else. Well, we do. So, this is what we're trying to do. So, Neighbors in Faith is working primarily outside of 25 miles up from the Space Needle. So, I'm happy to come and work in this area and other areas like Seattle and the East Side, right? But there's a lot of great work happening here. Where does the work need to happen? It needs to happen out in small towns like I grew up in. That's where a lot of it needs to happen. And so what we're trying to do is to celebrate and encourage neighborly relationships between Muslims and other people of faith or non-faith traditions, as individuals and households, as faith leaders, and as faith communities. And you'll be sad to know that that is news in some places. And to do so without thinking you have to solve, you know, all the centuries of theological disagreements. Like, just don't even worry about that right now. So do things that, like, faith communities know how to do. Eat together, play together, tell stories together, build stronger communities together. So do a food drive. Show up in the parade and engage public issues. And so what can local congregations do? And I know you guys are doing some of this. Like, this is great what you all are doing. I'm encouraging churches outside, you know, everywhere to get into local partnerships with other communities of faith, approach more vulnerable communities, and invite them in. And to do that in public. So if there's a parade your town puts on, do the parade together. If there's a large food drive going on, invite them to come and join you, and you stand at the celebration of that with them. That you do what you do in public. So yes, you know, take pictures, do social media, write a press release, which is a strong signal that to the rest of the community that you all recognize that your Muslim sisters and brothers, or your Hispanic sisters and brothers, or your Buddhist sisters and brothers, or whoever else it is, are like okay with you. Because even though only 30% of the population does some kind of religion in this neck of the woods, they still sort of trust Christians to sort of decide, like, you know, are people kind of okay? And so if you all say, hey, these folk are fine, folk are going to be more open. And then lastly, don't just think about your little area. Think about some kind of regional network. Because you all know what's happening with housing here in Seattle. It's gone bonkers. So where are people who are newly immigrated to this country or to this region going to go? They're not all going to go. They're not all going to live in this neighborhood. They're going to go out to some small town where they can get a cheaper place sometimes, right? And those small towns don't have a long history of interfaith relationship and may not have enough capacity. So reach out to some smaller church or some church out in the country somewhere and invite them to come to some of your bigger events, interfaith events. And what that will do over time is to build capacity and consciousness and some imagination, so that when a mosque or a Buddhist temple or something like that is coming into their community, the churches can join the city hall and the schools in welcoming it. So we have to think not only about right now, we've got to think about 10, 15, 20 years from now. But whatever you do, do it in public. And do it relationally. And there's some great resources for that. So one great thing is to sit around a table, have meal, make sure everybody's all mixed up, so there's people from different communities all together. And then ask a simple question. And like one I like was, when did you first feel that you were really part of your faith community? And mine was when I was like 6 years old. I just found out my mom had multiple sclerosis, so we thought she was going to die. Our family was kind of disoriented. I got to the Christmas tree lighting late, and all the Christmas tree was filled with ornaments. And somebody told me, oh, Terry, you're too late. The tree's all full. Which was ridiculous. You never say that to a six-year-old kid. But one of the members knew this. He was a kind of a contractor, an independent little, you know, built things for people. And he took me over. He says, Terry, come on over here. So I went over, picked an ornament. And then he lifted me up, and I was a big, chunky boy, I'll tell you what. And he picked me up, and he lifted me high up on the tree. And I can still tell you, I can still point where in that tree that ornament was, and I looked at it every single week that tree was up. And I knew that I belonged there. Well, Muslims have had the same kind of experiences. Buddhists have. Hindus have. So remember that we're human, right? In a time when all of our anxieties and some of the pressures that are around us, some of the policies that are taking place at our national level, leading us to forget it. And wouldn't it be great if instead of our churches having to preach sermons 20 years from now, how we should have been there for the Muslims, how we should have been there for the GLBTQIA community, how we should have been there for other vulnerable groups. Instead, we just did it. And instead of making it some big national emergency, we just made it into part of our life together. It's just part of what we do. And here's the last thing I'll say. I know that in my own life as a Christian, I have sometimes identified like who I am as a Christian by who I'm not. Right? But what if we recognized our identity as Christians because of who we are? That we're God's holy and beloved children. And when we realize we're God's holy and beloved children, then what else do we realize? That everybody else is God's holy and beloved children too. And we're called to love them. So maybe we can be gathered around a strong center instead of a strong fence, right? Instead of strong barriers against other people. And I know maybe we're not always ready for that. I know that could be a challenge for all of us. But remember what Jesus said during kind of a challenging moment. Did he say, "Father, forgive them if they repent of what they did. Father, forgive them if they become like me. Father, forgive them if they trust in the name of Jesus." No? So in that moment of death, even then, he was valuing other people as human beings and God's holy and beloved children, even if they didn't know it. And I just want to say that many of the Muslims I've met, they know that they're God's holy and beloved children. It's just God's found them a different way. Right? And I don't know how to understand that. I don't feel a call to be Muslim, but I think I'm called to love them. Thanks for listening. Thank you. So I know we went over a little bit, but so if you need to go, you can go. But if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer, or respond. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Well, I didn't know. First of all, I didn't feel like I knew enough. And then part of it was, like, I have seen folk, I mean, I live in Anacortes, I have seen folk just get ranting, raving, you know, so fearful that they can't almost control themselves when you start talking about Islam or Muslims. And, like, how do you handle that? And what happens if it turns into something more than ranting? You know, I mean, we held an event the day after the first so-called Muslim ban was put out. And I was scared that day too, because it felt like permission had been given to hate Muslims. And in fact, one of the women at that event said, "Well, you know, our president has said that Muslims are a danger to our country. And that's why I'm here tonight to say we should not have a mosque in our town." So I was afraid of that, right? And at a number of our events, we've had to have police, and we have had to have some people removed from our venues because they could not control their own inner rage and fear and anger and all that stuff. I am proud to say that quite a few times the police were able to talk to them out in the narthex or somewhere, wherever outside, and then bring them back on in. And that quite a few times people have actually hugged me afterward. Right? So, like, that's a win, right? I had one guy scream at me in a church. He just stood up and started screaming. And so, you're saying that those people that kill babies and kill and chop off hands and chop off heads, you're saying that those people are okay with... And he was, like, not okay with this, right? And so I had to, like, say to him, "Look, man, I love Jesus too, right? I really do. And I love our country too, right? I want us to be safe. But I also want us to be safe from our own fears." And I'll just say one more thing. I often say, who benefits from us being so afraid? You think those people that give all those millions of dollars, that you think they give that without thinking they're going to get something back? Who benefits? And then who pays? Who pays for our fear? Right? Who pays? And then I try to tell churches, right, that are starting to do this work. I said, look, you know, at some point, there'll be enough pressure on Muslims in this country where some unbalanced person who has some tangential relationship to a mosque is going to go off and do something dumb. And then the pressure will ramp up even more. And the pressure will ramp up even more because somebody else will do something dumb. The entire Muslim community is holding their breath right now. Right? Hoping that nobody goes off and does something dumb and violent. Right? The Harvard says that the more people are connected to a mosque, the less likely they are to engage in violence. But they're afraid of that. And when that happens, the same language that was used about the judges are going to be used about you. And y'all better do a gut check right now and make sure that you're ready for that. Because that could happen. I'm not saying it will, but I'm saying it could. It seems like it's in the cards right now. So we have to like sort of, you know, find our strength, find our center here in this moment, and know that we could be called some interesting names. And so it's just amazing to engage that level of like almost possession by fear. Like it's almost the kind of possession in a way. And I don't deny people's pain, right? And we always want to acknowledge people's pain. Because I had a little bit of pain too. I didn't have anybody die on September 11th, but it was a terrible, terrible day for all of us, right? So I acknowledge that. But then, as people of faith, we got to say, okay, how do we evaluate our pain? How do we live with it? How do we heal it? How do we heal, help each other heal? How are we healed by God? And then how do we begin to act out differently so we don't magnify the pain, but we actually do something like what Jesus did with it? So that's what I was afraid of. Like, could I stand in that space and not make a total idiot out of myself? I was going to say something else, but yeah. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. I agree.
I find myself feeling rage.
Yes.
About that.
Yeah.
And
right.
What congregations could do first one year out of church.
Right.
Having a conversation, having a chance.
Yep.
Inviting a different out of
church. Yeah. I agree. And because I have often felt excluded from being a, you know, within the bounds of followers of Jesus by some of those folk. And maybe they felt the same the other way too. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, Lutheran and Episcopalian traditions can be so head-oriented that we think that more people who connect to God more emotionally are somehow, you know, missing cranial space or something. And that's not fair, right? So sometimes we can get judgmental about the way they express some things too, you know, so maybe they have some pain too. But yeah, I've had quite a few evangelicals or fundamentalists try to either convert me or put me down. And it's amazing how often that's happened with me as a pastor. Because they'll say to me, like, well, Terry, you seem to love Jesus. Like, what's wrong with you? You know, you're... So, yeah, I think that's right on. The question is, what's the priority right now? Right? And I sort of feel like it's a bigger priority to get into relationship with more vulnerable populations in this country at this moment. And then maybe a second or third step is to begin that other... Other comments? Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Yeah, so there are some really great organizations doing excellent work, and one of them is Kids for Peace, and I do a lot of work. I do some work with them, and I try to talk about them everywhere I didn't tonight, but they get youth together from all different kinds of faith backgrounds. They help the kids understand each other's faith tradition, and then they just have a whole lot of fun with each other. And what I should tell you is that your congregation is among many who are working on this. So in Bellingham, there's St. Paul's Episcopal and the Lutheran churches up there, and the, all kinds of folk are getting together with the mosque up there. That's just starting. There's work happening in Everett right now. There's work happening in like Monroe. With a mosque out there. There's work happening in Linwood, in Edmonds, in North Seattle. Out on the east side, there's all kinds of stuff starting to happen. Obviously, after the shooting of the sick gentleman, there was Kent Lutheran Church put on a big thing, and there was a big deal happening out there. So it's really amazing how 2 years ago, interfaith relationships seemed like, okay, it's nice once in a while. Like right now, it sort of seems like central to faith. Like it seems like it's strategically the thing that has to happen right now. And what I'm trying to say to people is, don't think of it as an emergency. Think of it as an ongoing kind of commitment to reduce the kind of tribalism that is in us. Right? And to build those kind of relationships for the future. Yeah. Yes?
What are the top three congregational
connections in the mosque? That would be practical? Yeah. Yeah. So I think just having people show up at mosques for the Friday prayers, that they usually happen between noon and one, and just have people regularly go over there. It doesn't take all that much time. They're super welcoming. You take off your shoes. You go. Usually they give me a seat in the back, a folding chair, because I'm related to the Tin Man and I just can't do the floor at all. I just can't. But they'll welcome you in. I think having multi-faith dinners and meals is really, really good. You get people gathered around food, that's good. And especially if you can develop teams of people from the different communities working together to organize it, because then you get people learning each other, even more deeply, right? And then look around the community, and if the food bank is going to have a food drive, like do the simple things with them. Don't try to start to invent a whole new wheel. Try to do what you already do, or if they're engaged in a food bank, in some kind of food drive, or something to kind of benefit the community, you all join them. So look for opportunities where the communities are already doing things, and don't try to make a whole lot of extra work. Fold this into the normal life of your community. Invite them to come and be with you at worship, or invite their imam to come and preach. Right? And, it'd be a different kind of Sunday a little bit, but their imam will probably have some really incredible things to say about Jesus. Not the same things that, that Christians believe about Jesus. But then not all Christians, in this room probably, right? So, believe exactly the same thing either. So, I think just making it part of your life. Yeah. All right, I feel like you guys did such a good job. You guys hung in there. We got started a little bit late, but you all were great. So really, thank you for listening so well tonight. Thank you. Oh, yeah. It's okay.